Okay, so we are recording at this point, and it picks up very well. There's an internal mic, so just you don't have to worry about like talking down to it or any of those sorts of things. And I start every interview, which helps for my transcripts, with your name. So if you can give me your name, as well as the years that you served in the SPARS.
Do you want my name before marriage? Or what?
I would, yeah, if I could get both.
Okay, Dorothy Riley Dempsey.
And Riley, R-I-L-E-Y?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Dempsey, D-E-M-P-S-E-Y. Okay.
And I lived in Pelham Bay, and I grew up on Long Island Sound, so that I knew I loved the water. And I grew up opposite a place called City Island, where they made all the sails and the ships. And most of my childhood was with boats and things. And when the war came along, my older brother went to work for Sperry Gyroscope out in Long Island, working on the Norden bomb site. And I wanted to help in some way. And I joined something called the American Women's Voluntary Services. Not many people know about it.
Mm-mm.
It was the first organization for women because there were no military organizations for us. And they had like a storefront in Pelham Bay. And we were trained in home nursing and Red Cross techniques. And when we finished that course, we were to take our information back to our neighborhood and get all the neighbors together and teach them how to take care of themselves, you know. Now, we were very sure at that time, about the time, just after Pearl Harbor, that we were the next target, because we were New York City. And if they did to us what they were doing, like over there in England, people started digging the foxholes out in the backyard, you know, and they felt that every neighborhood should be prepared in some way. And so this organization, we didn't dress in a uniform, we just wore a white blouse and a black skirt, and we finished that training. And then in the second phase, which often bothered me to think about, we were to learn about soup kitchens, because if we were bombed, how would you get food out to people? You had to know how to do it. So I started that work with them, and then that was, I think, the winter of 42, when the Army took the women in, and then that summer the Navy took them in, and in the fall, in November, the Coast Guard opened up, and so I wanted to go into one of the services that involved sea services, you know, and I went down with my best friend. And my father wouldn't hear of anybody wearing a uniform. Are you out of your mind? The neighbors would all be talking about you. I said, so what, you know? But anyway, I went down with this good friend, and we were sitting in Lower New York, I don't know where it was, Whitehall or something, and they took me in one room and took her in another across the hall, and I was sworn in. I came out, and she's sitting there sobbing. I said, what happened to you? She says, they don't want me. I said, you're strong and healthy. What do you mean they don't want you? I forgot I was born in Ireland. And she came here when she was two months old or something, didn't realize it. So I went up and said to the recruiter, look at her. She's a strong, healthy girl, and you need them. You should take her. He said, ma'am, if you're not born in this country, you are not going to serve. So anyway, I went ahead and I was sent to a boot camp in Florida. I thought at that time they were taking spars and waves together at Hunter College. I figured, well, I'm home, you know. But there was a switch over just about that time, and I ended up going to Florida. So for me, that was another world, you know. I'd never seen a palm tree.
It was the hotel over there, right where you were staying?
Yeah, mm-hmm, the Biltmore. And so when about 14 of us left from New York City, and my father was so stubborn, he just would not believe I was going until the day I left. So they're standing waving goodbye to all of us in Grand Central, and my father's got the Daily News like this. I said to my mother, she said, now my father would never cry. And so she said, he can't see you going into uniform. Well, anyway, I went ahead in. And when I was in Florida, I rode home a lot, and I was completely unprepared. All of us were. And this is what Oliver North wanted to know, too. How prepared were we going in? Our generation never had athletics or sports, so we were not prepared for a boot camp. So the first thing they did down in Florida was they put us in boot camp, and we had to jump through the tires, you know. Then the next thing we had to do was we had to scale a wall. We couldn't do it. I said to the girl in back of me, Quinn, push, because I'll never get over that wall. So we had more fun doing these things. And in one case, and when I think about it, I shouldn't, I don't know whether I mentioned it on Oliver North or not, but anyway, the first time I was on with them, and there was a big rope, and it had a knot on it, and there was a pit with mud in it here. We had to back up and then jump. And my friend Quinn that was with me also said, "Hey, Quinn, I'm never going to make that pit." She said, "Neither am I." So we sneaked onto another line. We never had to go over that. We didn't get caught. I said, "If we get caught, we're out. They'll get rid of us." But anyway, you know, you could really have a humorous way of living if you accept it. But if you sat and took it to heart, you would cry. And the girls often did. At night, you could hear them crying in their bunks. You know, "I can't do this. I can't do this." And they were strict, but that was the way they had to be. You live with other women in a room, well, in that generation anyway, and somebody might have dusting powder on the floor, the stockings hanging off the doorknob. They had to be that tough with us, you know. So when we got to boot camp, they gave us our clothing and everything, and they said, second deck starboard, first ladder, I said, "What language is that?" You know, and they said, "This is the kind you're going to have to speak from now on, nautical terms." So we had to learn those, and it was. I think I like that way of living. I thought this is the way it should be. You know, if we're going to learn and whatever we're going to do, we'll do it this way without having this one be so smart that one won't study and so on. You know, mm-hmm. Let's just do it the right way. So we had the one thing it's hard for people to understand, but there were no doors on any rooms.
They took the doors off of the hotel rooms?
All the doors were taken off, even in the bathroom.
Wow.
Well, I guess they didn't want anything to go on, and in those days we didn't even know what went on. You know, but, and you each had your bunk, and all you could have in your room was your suitcase under your bed. And the closets, your shirt had to have the tie on it, and the jacket, and everything facing in the same direction. And the shoes had to be just so, and the caps had to be on the shelf with the flip brim over them. And you really had nothing personal in your life anymore. And every two girls had a chest of drawers, and the bottom drawer had to stay, they were staggered, so that when the inspection party came along, they could look in and see if everything was just the way it should be. We were even told how to fold our slips and things like that, mm-hmm. You know, and I still do it today. Everything is in three, like you fold a towel in three, we fold our slips in three, our underwear in three, and pajamas and everything. But anyway, it was terrific training, and our classes were difficult at first because we had to learn all of military history, mm-hmm. and what each service meant, what the rank was, and what the stripes involved, and we knew nothing about that at all, you know. And drill was very hard for us because that was Palm Beach, Florida, and we were on a white drill ground with little white pebbles, and oh, it was terrible to walk in the heat with that, you know. And they always had an ambulance there because somebody always passed out. Excuse me, that's the way, you know, mm-hmm. You couldn't take the heat.
Well, I mean, if it's like, you know, like the way it is out here.
Oh, exactly. It's like you're in a you know, hot tub. So but anyway, we got through boot camp with our exams, and then they tested us for, I think, 2 full days. And I had gone in, the pastor in my parish at home had said I'd always work with the church and play the organ and do things. He said, "You should go in as a chaplain's assistant." I said, "Good idea, because I do want to help somehow." So I put that down on my, which is what they were going to do. They were going to send me to William and Mary in Virginia. That was the chaplain's assistant school. And the day of graduation, we were all on the quarter deck in our dress uniforms, and the lieutenant stood in front of us. I think 125, if it's 150, I forget. She called my name. She said, "Seaman Riley, front and center. Commanding officer wants to see you." I said, "Oh, God, I didn't even get out. Didn't graduate. Now what did I do?" So she said, when I got in there, she said, "What is your religion?" I said, "Roman Catholic, sir." She said, "What made you think you could be a chaplain's assistant?" I said, "It's written in the book." Shouldn't have said that. But anyway, she said...
Why shouldn't you have said that?
Because you don't question an officer. And, of course, I wasn't too new at it. But I said, well, I was told when I enlisted that would be a fine thing to do, you know. And she said, can you serve on the altar? I said, no, sir, I can't. Can you do this and that? I said, no. So those were the days when just boys were allowed to do things. She said, then you're not going on. I said, well, what will I do? She said, well, being you've worked with women all along, we'll put you in that area, you know, and probably in personnel or something like that. So I didn't get to go to William and Mary. I got boarded the train with my friends from Long Island. The whole group of us went up to Boston, and that's where we were stationed. We worked in Boston where, I don't know if you're familiar with it, where Old Ironsides is today. And there was a building called the Fargo Building. The Navy and the Coast Guard shared it. But we weren't allowed to live in the city because that was a sailor's town. So they took over a an apartment hotel out in Brookline near Wellesley. And that's where we lived. So the way it ended up was that I was master-at-arms at that barracks, so my job was to oversee the 406 women that were there. You had to know where they were each day on my report, you know, with the roster. Are they home? Are they on leave? Are they in sick bay? Or where are they, you know? And I gradually began to pick up a lot of what they wanted me to do. And it didn't sound like much, but it was a responsible job. If you didn't have it, everything just so, you were at fault. And at night, when I was on the night watch, which went on at 11 to 7, I had to do bed check. And there were big numbers on every bunk, you know, and I'd just flash the flashlight on. I'd see a body, and I'd check it off and so on. And one of them fooled me. And I know people say you probably read that in the book. I said, no, I didn't. But some girl made her pillows look like a figure, and she wasn't there. And when they had roster in the morning, she was missing. And I got called in. Where did she go? I said, sir, it looked just like a body. And I said, I wasn't going to go up and take the blanket off over her head. But anyway, I got in trouble because I didn't double check, you know. But also...
And where, it, where was she? Had she gone...
AWOL.
She went AWOL.
And, well, they finally caught her, you know. But a lot of them, once they got in, the women found it very hard. Because our generation never left home. You never lived away unless you could go to college, and we couldn't afford it in those days. So you were really just used to your family and your grandparents and your aunts and uncles and children, I mean, cousins. You didn't have too many contacts in the outside world. Now you were suddenly threw in with all of these other people that you had to live with, so you had to accept all those personalities, you know. But part of my job, too, was if you would see a girl, say, when they'd come off duty, crying or something, you to go over and sit and talk to her. A little psychology thrown in, you know. And then as time went on, I had a musical background, and this fellow in Boston, his name was Professor Braslovsky, I think, and he wanted to do his share. He was Polish, and he formed a glee club in our barracks, and I think we had 50 voices. Did a fantastic job. And then one day, some people came in and they auditioned, quite a few of us, and they took six of us out of that chorus. And I said, what are they going to do with us? We said, we didn't know. But that's at the time that our finances and the war, everything was at such a pressure that what they came up with in the idea was war bond shows. I don't know whether you ever heard that or not. But they would have a show that consisted of all military people, written by them, choreography and so on, and that they would, our group that we were with traveled all over New England. So we were taken off our regular duty. I had been doing some recruiting on Boston radio, singing with a group, and then telling them what it was like to be in the women's service. And so I went, we met in Boston, six spas, six waves, and six wax. And then, you probably didn't know the name, Cesar Romero, used to be, well, I worked for Cesar Romero. He was fantastic. And as a kid from the Bronx, I was in awe of him. But he was such a wonderful guy, you know? And anyway, they needed a movie star as an attraction to draw the people in. And foolishly, they picked somebody called Veronica Lake. She used to have her hair that fell this way. She couldn't get along with anyone in the case. So they got rid of her, and they got Cesar Romero because he had just come back from the South Pacific in the Coast Guard, and he had been through a number of landings that were bad, and he was like recuperating. So they thought they'd put him in the show, and all he had to do was speak to the people, and he portrayed something that he was at the time, like Mexican or something. Mm-hmm. Well, he would do that for them, you know. So we did our put our things together, did the scenery, whatnot, and we had our tryout in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and it went over so well as the first war bond show that we went on the road and we traveled all over New Bedford, and we would be maybe someplace for a weekend or during the week, and we had rehearsals every day and then a show at night, you know. And a lot of things happened during the show, which was really, really funny. This one fellow that they brought in, his name was Frankie Fontaine. He was a comedian.
The name's, I don't know if the name is just familiar because it's been in a, it's like, it's one of those names, or if I actually have heard of him.
You probably heard of him. He was, he had an act, and he was John C. Savoni or something like that, and he wore this old beat-up fedora, and he was really funny. So anyway, he was in the Army, and they brought him into the show after we had started. And he must have been married and had kids, because most of us in those days weren't. And he kept sneaking off on weekends or something to get home to see the family. So I don't know what happened, but the men got really mad because he didn't come back one time. So they took his hat from wherever he was, you know, sleeping, and they hid the hat. Well, the show couldn't go on because his act was part of it. So the lieutenant got everybody together and says, you're all grounded until that hat shows up. So nobody said a word, but the theater we were playing in, Danvers, Massachusetts, I think, it had all of these busts of people in these windows. One of them was wearing his hat. Nobody ever noticed it. But anyway, but there were little things that happened within the show that were really... That were really great. But no matter what town that we played in, the Kiwanis or the somebody would always have us for dinner. We got so sick of chicken, mashed potatoes, and peas, we didn't want to look at it again. We said, do we have to, you know? But and then occasionally we would get like a pass for one day or something, you know, and you could go to see the scenery or whatnot. But that was quite an experience because... Skitch Henderson was the arranger and the pianist with the show. And just being with these professional people, like when I wasn't, a lot of us weren't, you know, we learned a lot, mm-hmm. you know, and Toots Camarada was the band leader, and some of the names, I can't even remember them myself, you know, but years later, Frankie Fontaine came to the theater in the town that I live in, New Jersey, in Lyndhurst. And my husband said, go and see him. I said, hey, that was years ago. You know, no, I won't go. Well, anyway, I think it was 10 years ago. Yeah, about 10 years ago. The mayor in my town called and he said, Dot, did you work with Frankson, with Cesar Romero? I said, how did you know? I never told anybody. He said, I got ways. He said, now he's coming to Rutherford. Tomorrow, and we want you to go and meet with him. I said, forget it. I said, he's from Hollywood. He wouldn't remember a kid from the show years ago. He said, bring all your pictures. I'm sending a limo down to get you. I said, oh, what will my kids think, you know? Well, anyway, I went to the theater. I was a nervous wreck. I said, look, I'm white-haired. I said, I was but 21 when I met him, you know? But anyway, when we got to the theater, they had all the TV lights and all this business out, and he came out, and I said, don't even pretend you know me, because I know you don't. And he was just, he was so tall. He was a very striking looking man. So they had us in a special room, and we sat and we talked, and he was so nice. And I said, do you ever meet with your shipmates? And after a while, when I showed him the pictures, and I said, do you remember the show that we were in, the war bond show? He said, oh yeah, he said. And I think we ran for, I don't know how many months. But anyway, he said, oh yeah, I remember that, you know. And so we talked for quite a while. I said, do you ever get together with your own shipmates? He said, yes, I do. I said, do you ever see Sid Caesar? And he said, oh yeah. He said, Sid Caesar Victor Mature, and who was the third one? I forget. He said, we were all Coast Guard. And but anyway, it was quite an experience being on. And then when I went back on my regular job, I kind of missed all this hullabaloo that I'd been on, you know. But before that began, because I had been doing some recruiting, singing, they took the few of us, I think there were five or six of us, I think. But anyway, we were sent to Maine, to Senator Margaret Chase Smith's home. I don't know if you know anything about her.
I know the name.
But she pioneered women in the military.
That's right. That's why I know the name.
She was the first woman in the Senate. She replaced her husband when he died. And so she wanted us to come to Maine. And she had signed personal invitations to every eligible girl from Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire. And we were to go to her home and act as hostesses, show slides of the spars, tell them what life was like and what our jobs were like and so on, and help serve tea and all that. And she had a huge Victorian mansion, and I couldn't believe I was in a senator's house. She was lovely, you know. Mm-hmm. And she said, I hope you women appreciate the fact that you are the pioneers, and keep going, keep at it as long as you can. Do everything you can for women, you know. So we worked up with her that, for, I guess, must have been a weekend. But and one of the very funny incidents that when I look back at that day, when we arrived at this town called Skowhegan, Maine, the lieutenant that was with us, she was an Army lieutenant, but I don't know how she got, she must have been in PR work, but she said, now you're to march down the main street. We said, there's only, what, say six of us. You still have to march down the main street. And we looked out at the main street, and there were two, like, hotels with porches on them, and everybody in town was sitting there rocking away, waiting for this big parade. There was no parade, it was us. But there was a brass band in front of us. And I said, hey, listen, let's go shoulder to shoulder, because they're going to wonder where we came. We marched down that street with everybody clapping and cheering. We felt like goofs, you know. But a lot of the things that you learned to appreciate, the amount of work and planning that went into it, you know. And I did miss my own job with working with the women. And so when I got back, that was the just twice that I was taken off on temporary duty, you know. But I really did enjoy working with the women and the jobs that we had to do, you know. And I had met this fellow before I went to uniform. I met him at Christmas time. I went in March, and he had just graduated from officers training in Texas, and he went overseas, and I thought, well, I'll never see him again, but boy, he was the kind of fellow I would like to get to know better, you know. So I think it was toward the end of my term. I was in from 43 to 46, and in the spring of 46, they came out with the point system. You could accumulate so many points, then you could get out. Well, I actually liked being in there, you know. And but then again, I thought, this fellow had been writing to me all the time and sending me pictures, and he wanted to see me and everything. And so I thought, well, let's see what happens. So he came up to Boston when he came home, and I waited for him in Back Bay Station, and he walked right by me. I thought, wait a minute, he never did see me in uniform. Probably doesn't recognize me, you know. But anyway, he spent like 3 days or so up in Boston, and we got to know one another a little bit better, you know. And he was on terminal leave. He was really finished. He'd spent 5 years mm-hmm. in the Army. So I thought, well, I'll see how things go. I probably should get out now and go home and so on. But all of the experience, I think, that I had when I was in is just, it's lasted with me. It was a big imprint in my life, you know, and I think encouraged me to do other things with women ever since then, you know, which I've done. And to get back to this business about being on with Oliver North, I didn't know anything about this. I got a call from Channel 5, and they said, would you be willing to come in and speak to us about the women in the Coast Guard?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes, I certainly would. I'd like to tell the world what we did. I said we not only were mechanics, and a lot of our women worked in decoding and things.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, we'd like to ask you some questions, and could you wear your uniform and so on? And so, which doesn't fit, of course, comes to here these days, you know. So I just bought a navy blue blazer and transferred all my insignia, and I went into New York City, and they taped, but I thought they would have the makeup people there, but they didn't. I thought, oh boy, where do they see these wrinkles, you know. But that was what he wanted. He wanted people to see that these World War II women were still around, and this is what they had done with their lives mm-hmm. after they left there. And like many of the women that I've known, not only in the Coast Guard but the Navy, we used our GI Bill. We got our degrees that way,
mm-hmm.
Even though we were having these children, and we got them on Saturdays and weekends and whatnot, and we used our knowledge that we had. And but I think of anything I did in my life, my greatest education was being in the military.
Let me jump back here, because I mean,
yes.
This is wonderful, and I, there are so many places where I want to say, but I'm glad that I just let you talk, because...
Well, I thought you would ask me a question. I'd probably
no,
I talked was, your ear off.
No,
right
no,
now.
Please. This is wonderful. But there are so many things. But let's back way back.
Yes.
And start with, tell me a little bit about growing up in the Bronx.
All right. I grew up in Fordham, and near Fordham University. And then my family moved to Pelham Bay. They thought that was getting to be too city-like. There were three of us. They wanted us out of that situation. And in Pelham Bay, we...
How old were you when you moved there?
To Pelham Bay?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe about 8.
Okay.
And in those days, everything was homebound, families, and it's a lot of closeness. And our church, which is an unusual thing... there was no church, so this priest...
What do you mean there was no church?
There was no building.
Okay.
This priest was a real shoppy. He rented a circus tent. And he put up this circus, believe me, a huge circus tent, and rented all these chairs, and had his first parish. And
Was this in Fordham or in Pelham Bay?
Pelham Bay.
Okay.
Near Pelham Bay Park, you know. And I thought, oh, this is great. Look, we can go to church in a tent, you know. But anyway, life up there was very... we went to the Catholic school, and he also was smart enough to buy the Westchester Country Club, which they were selling and moving further up in Westchester.
Mm-hmm.
So this country club was in... just off from Pelham Bay, and it was called the Country Club Section. It had two of these stanchions, you know, and like where there was somebody sitting in a box, but they didn't by the time we bought the house in there. But it was growing up in a wonderful way, I think, you know, with picnics and family sharing things, and we had like church bazaars, and we had big picnics in the park, as I say, and all the neighborhood would go, you know. And those are people who bought houses in the country club. It was at a time in the 30s when nobody had money.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how my father ever got money, but I was too young to realize, you know. But he had saved every nickel. In fact, I found a book that had all the nickels and the quarters that he got. He had everything listed in there, because he had come up from nothing. And his father died when he was maybe 14,
mm-hmm.
I guess. And he had to quit school and take care of his mother and the three other children. And his mother used to do the wash for the New York University, the teachers,
mm-hmm.
up in the Heights. Did you ever hear the Heights?
Mm-hmm.
And then he built a wagon, and he'd take the wash back and forth and so on. And the tape that he did for me is when all of this came out. I didn't know anything about it, never talked about it. And he said he used to go to the railroad yards, which were not far from the house, and he would scrounge through for coal, and that would give them the heat to heat the apartment that they had. And then he got a job doing something for $1 a week, and he said that at least gave us a dollar, you know. Well, anyway, we didn't learn about that until we were maybe about 10 or so, you know, that he had had this kind of a hard life. And yet here we were living in this beautiful, it was a Tudor house, mm-hmm. with the big beams in the living room and the Tudor front on it. And to me, it was a house, I didn't know it was different, but when I got older and the girl said, "Wow, what a house." And I said, "It's just my home, you know." But growing up as a, in those years, that would be, say, maybe I was 10, 11, and 12, all of the families that owned houses in that area belonged to a country club. And we had our swimming meets, and we, in fact, we used to swim at night. We'd meet on the beach, and everybody brought their own potato and their own hot dog, and we'd have a beach fire, and we'd swim at night. And when you swim in the dark, the water looks silver, phosphorus or something, you know. And then we were always doing things. We never needed chaperones or anything. We just had a great time, you know.
A lot of these years when you were growing up, during the Depression. I mean, it doesn't sound, but it sounds like, I mean, did it really, it doesn't seem like it affected your family.
It did to a degree. My father just bought the house when he lost his job. Mm. And he thought he was going to lose everything, you know. And we were not allowed to listen to the conversations, and we were sent down the cellar, you know, and nobody can hear what they were talking about. But my mother said she could go and cook at the convent and get paid that way and so on. And my father decided that the best thing he could do is, he had been working for General Motors, and they let every one of the older employees go. He was a mechanic, and they replaced him with younger men. Mm. But my father said he'd spent all of those years working for General Motors, for the Buick Company, mm-hmm. and he deserved more than that. So they made him a salesman, and he said, "I'm not a salesman, I'm a mechanic," you know. But anyway, he got the books in the library, and he studied on salesmanship and everything. And the shop that he worked in was on the Grand Concourse, which was a lot of the Jewish movie stars, Sylvia Sidney and everybody. He got to know all of them. Mm-hmm. And they depended upon him when they bought a car and different things. And he kind of worked his way through losing his job. And then he said to my mother, "I've got to have a different way of having something in our future, you know." So he went into civil service in New York City, and he worked for The Little Flower. Did you ever hear? Mm. Fiorello LaGuardia.
Oh, yeah, LaGuardia, yes.
Well, he was my father's boss. My father did something with cars and things that belonged to, like, the mayor, mm-hmm. the fire chief, and all this sort of thing. And my father went to work the first day, and the cleaning woman was in there. Nobody was sitting at a desk, and he said, "Where is everybody?" She said, "What do you come to work for? This is St. Rocco's feast day." The mayor said, "No work, no work." So my mother said, "You lost the job the first day." He said, "No, it's St. Rocco's feast day or something." Nobody's there, you know. So, but things began to pick up, and his job was doing well. And then my older brother was working at the local library, and then he started at NYU at night. Mm-hmm. And my younger brother was too young at the time to do anything. So when the war came along, Pearl Harbor, that was a Sunday, and we were all sitting in the house. I think I liked to paint and sketch, and I was doing something, and we heard this extra out in the street, and we said, "Extra." We ran out, and somebody was selling papers. "United States has been attacked by Japan." Mm-hmm. And my father says, "Japan couldn't attack us. Where is Pearl Harbor?" So we had to get the globe of the world out, and we're all looking on the globe, and what are they doing down there, you know? We really couldn't believe that such a thing could happen. From that day on, all life changed. Definitely changed. Mm-hmm. And everybody went out to do something, you know? And, like, when the air raid siren blew, my mother would put on her Red Cross cap, and she'd go to the school where they had bandages, they were cutting material. My father would get his air raid warden hat, and my a brother that was older than me that couldn't go into the military because of working on the Norden bomb site. I forget what he did, but the younger one was a Boy Scout, and he had to go around and make sure all the windows had no light coming mm-hmm. out of them, you know. And so I think we were a very typical family. Everybody in a family wanted to help and do something, and that was the start of the way our life changed.
How did you? You told me about this service group. Was this just that you were in initially?
The American Women's Voluntary Service. Yeah.
How was this just a New York based group, or were there branches all over the country? I mean, I've just never heard of them before.
They might have been just New York. I don't know. I never checked into it.
Interesting.
Because New York was so sure. Mm-hmm. If they could bomb Pearl Harbor, and if they look what they're doing over in London with all this,
right.
We're next. Mm-hmm. And people today don't believe that. But they did start digging their shelters in the backyard. And people started putting water on the side. And but everybody was taking part in something, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to say, but there was a distinct change from that Sunday on. Life never was the quiet Sunday afternoons and different things. Everybody was busy doing something, you know.
I know that in New York at that time, specifically, I mean, in a lot of the, in some of the enclaves of the Bronx and some mm-hmm. Eastern New York and things, there was a lot of the New Left and all of those sorts of organizations.
Yes, yes.
Were you involved with any of that?
Well, you know, they did try to get into it. It was a communist mm-hmm. background thing.
Yeah.
And because we were so eager to do something, we didn't recognize what was being thrown at us. And finally in the schools, they began to say, you've got to watch who you're talking to and whatnot and so on. And we were going by a newsstand or something. It had all the papers about the communists doing so and so. And I don't know how I ever got the nerve to do it, but I accidentally, on purpose, bumped the newsstand and the papers went all over the ground. We all started to run. And I said, well, I did my bit, you know, mm-hmm. laughingly. But the world definitely changed. And it was very, very hard to... I found it hard to leave home. But as I say, women didn't leave home mm-hmm. unless they went to college. And we didn't have that much because the Depression had just been over, you know.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Because of being involved in music, we used to, I thought this was nice, growing up when we had the house, on Sunday afternoons, all of the neighbors would gather at my house because the ceiling was a cathedral ceiling and mm-hmm. the sound would go up and somebody brought his violin, somebody else brought his drums, and my father had the banjo, and my brother had the saxophone, and I played the piano, and the women would bring in baked beans or a cake, and they'd sit around and chit-chat, and we'd play all these songs, and mm-hmm. it was on Sunday afternoons, and it was great, you know. And from that, my brother that was just 2 years older than me, he was in a band, a dance band, and I think that was before Pearl Harbor, Matty James and his Country Club Orchestra, and the piano player used to drink a lot. And when he was really drunk and couldn't go for a gig, my brother would say, come on, get your chip clothes on. You got to fill in for him, which I loved. Mm-hmm. And so every time they had a gig, I eventually ended up playing for them, you know. But then Pearl Harbor hit like about 2 years into that. And this one got drafted, that one got drafted, this one enlisted, and then I enlisted. So the whole band fell apart, you know.
How old were you when Pearl Harbor happened?
Let's see, what was that, 40...
41?
41, yeah. I must have been 19.
Okay.
I couldn't go in right away because the Coast Guard didn't take them.
Right. No, I know. The Coast Guard, I mean, I realize that. Before Pearl Harbor, what did you think you were going to do with your life? You said everything changed after Pearl Harbor. So before then, what were your thoughts?
Well, I wanted to do something in, I had worked a little bit in photography, mm-hmm. Doing retouching back in those days. They took portraits in studios mm-hmm. and where I worked, this little company, this is before everything, you know, I went into service, we worked in a dark room with the negative, and we were taught how to etch on that negative mm-hmm. with like a scalpel or something, and then fill it in. And so I liked photography very much, and I thought maybe I could make that a life's work, you know. But it was very hard for women to get into. You couldn't do that.
What did you think? I mean, did you think as a woman that you would have what we would nowadays call, you know, a career? Did you think that, or did you expect, yes. you were expecting to do that?
Yeah, I wanted to. Yeah, I really did. And of course, as I say, my father was very strong-willed, but I guess he had a reason, I don't know, to do that. But he said, you're not going in for any kind of artsy thing. He said, because you're going to get married sometime, and you're going to forget it. He said, you're going to a business school. I said, I hate working. I want to work in an office. Well, anyway, I went into an office. I took a course called Contameter, which was something similar to an adding machine.
Okay.
Added, multiplied, subtracted, and whatnot. And then I worked for, I thought this was funny, you know, Oscar Mayer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was Stahlmeier, two little German fellas. They looked like German Smith brothers. They had no hair, little mustaches, same size. And they had this big factory in Harlem. And they made the hot dogs and the sausages and the liverwurst and all that stuff. And I had always loved that kind of thing. And my mother would say, what's the matter with you? I got a roast beef and you want a liverwurst sandwich? But I like that sort of thing. So anyway, when I got this job, she said, thank God, now you won't want all this liverwurst. I loved it even more. But that's when they were bringing in air raid drills. And because this was a German company, they were very tough. And we worked in the office part above the plant, you know. And in order to get out of the building, we had to go through all these machines. And I saw where they had all the spices, and I loved it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when that's where I left to go into the military.
How did you hear about the spars?
Well, I looked up the Navy, and I didn't want the Army. And I thought, well, gosh, you know, the Coast Guard, I've seen boats and ships out here once in a while in our bay, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I found different, this was, I don't know when it was, but one Easter I was down there with my brother and some other friends on the dock at the country club. And I said, what is that stick coming up out of the water? It was a conning tower from a sub.
Mm.
But we didn't know that. And we were talking about it later. And my brother, the older brother, said, you know, I think that's part of a sub. I said, how would a sub get into Pelham Bay?
Mm-hmm.
But it was able to do it. And if it could get into Pelham Bay, down past Kings Point where the Merchant Marine Academy, it could be right in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the area that we lived in was really being staked out. And it wasn't until after the war and years later that we thought about it. You know, they said, mm-hmm. gee, they really did try to get in here, you know. But I just wanted to be with anything that had to do with water.
Did you remember seeing, like, I mean, you know, I mean, like how, like any newsreels about it or any magazine articles
yes.
or anything?
Yes.
Because I'm just wondering, curious, like how they got the word out there that you could join.
Well, it first came out, I would say, in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see the women at Hunter College marching, and I thought, gee, that's really something, you know? And I thought, maybe I could work in my photography with that, and then you had to have a letter of admittance, and my father wouldn't give it to me. So I went to the pastor, because I played the organ for him and different things, and he said, yes, you could go in as chaplain's assistant, and I really thought I could.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't ease my father's attitude at all, but anyway, I used his letter when I went in, and after I did, I was a nervous wreck because my friend Pat and I were going to do everything together, as we always had done.
And then she didn't get accepted.
And she couldn't go.
Mm.
She cried all the way home, and she said, you're leaving me. I said, I'm not leaving you. I'll get to see you. You can come and see wherever I am. She said, you know I can't travel, you know, whatnot. But anyway, and my friends, the girls I'd always hung out with at school, they gave me a shower, you know, gave me my ID bracelet and all this kind of stuff, you know, but as time got nearer, I really got scared. Where am I going, you know, and I'm leaving my own bedroom and so on, and but I said, I made the choice, I'm going to have to follow it through, you know.
It was a huge adventure.
Oh, yeah, and I think that was the beginning of my being able to make choices. A lot of people can't do that, couldn't. And that taught me that it was very important. You take a chance and you do something, you know. But I think I said I brought that out that this last time I was on Oliver North in May, I didn't even know I was on. But what he did was he took segments of this original program that he had, which was Army, Navy, Coast Guard, Marines, and so on. And his objective was this Mother's Day, that was when it came on, that yes, there are mothers. There are mothers who were nurses, mothers who are this, that. Mm-hmm. And there are mothers who served in World War II. Mm-hmm. And these are the mothers that we should be remembering today. So he took different segments out. And that somebody called me and said, you're on TV. I said, I don't think so. They said, you are. I said, oh, geez. You know, but anyway. But it was the greatest education in the world. Even the college education that I did get. I went to Rutgers. And then I went to Kane College, mm-hmm. Kane University, and got my degree in teaching. But what I've always seemed to lean to, I taught from the fourth grade through the eighth grade, and history was wasn't my major, but education was. But the more I went into what I had done mm-hmm. that people didn't know about, I felt they should know about women who served. So I, after I retired 16 years ago, the teachers kept calling and saying, would you come in and talk about women in the military? I said, sure, I will. So I worked out a program, and I've been doing that since I retired. And when I first started, this is an example. They set up the really good students, the honor students, in all the 7th and 8th grades, and they said, now, if you'll talk to them about World War II. And I thought, well, I'm going to let them tell me what they know. Mm-hmm. And I said, what do you remember of World War II? And they all looked at me and said, World War II? I said, Pearl Harbor, was that World War II? I said, it sure was. And I said, Hitler? Oh, you mean the crazy guy? They knew nothing about mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, we're going to start from scratch. So anyway, I worked up a different way of making a presentation, and I would bring in my spar uniform on a hanger and my husband's tank destroyer. He was in the Hell on Wheels division. Mm-hmm. And I'd hang them up in the classroom, and I went to the American Legion. They gave me a flag in the South Pacific, the big Jap flag, a huge one. And I think it was the VFW. I got them to give me a flag that flew over the Nuremberg trials and had all the signatures mm-hmm. on it. So I thought, okay, this is the way I'll work it out. When I go into a room, I'll say, I need you, and you to stand and hold this flag. And they were wondered what was going on. Mm-hmm. And then once I got their attention and got them, the major thing I tried to tell all of them was that this was a world war. It wasn't fought in one place, it was fought to save lives and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I asked the teachers, if I'm going to speak to them, you've got to give me a map of the world with a red felt marker so they can all have it, so that they know that we were in the South Pacific and we were in Europe. Mm-hmm. And how could you supply that many people the manpower? And this was the purpose of women, that the men would be released for active duty and we would do the shore jobs, because we never served overseas. Mm-hmm. Hawaii and Alaska, that was about it.
Did you ever think? I mean, because you're talking about, and you've talked a little bit kind of around some of this, but this, you know, and one of the women that the senators that you went to go visit was saying, you know, you guys, you were
Mama
trailblazers.
Chasers.
Yeah, you were pioneers.
Yes.
Did that kind of, I mean, did you feel like a sense of responsibility then now to the
that
next
was the
generation?
First time I did. I don't think any of us, we went on with our jobs and got into everything, you know. Mm-hmm. But never realizing the impact we were going to have on people until she said that. And she said, stand up for what you believe in and let them know why you wanted to help your country. So that's what we tried to do. I felt it anyway. I felt it, the personal responsibility.
And so what about, you know, afterwards when you, like, you know, you raised your daughter and these sorts of things? I mean, how did that influence your raising of her?
Well, I never did speak much about it when I was raising them because I was really busy, and unfortunately my husband had been in so much combat that he was going into these depressions. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning I didn't recognize it. And as time went on, and he would not go to work and he'd stay home, and I didn't know how to handle it because there was no way I could work because I had two girls by then, you know, mm-hmm. and just wasn't working out. So I didn't really have much time to think of anything. And when they got older and they were, one of them said to me one day, could I wear your uniform to a masquerade? I said, sure, Joan, you can, you know, go get it in the attic and so on. And then occasionally they would, I did keep in touch with my best friends, my best, mm-hmm. the roommates in the spars, and unfortunately they're all gone. Mm. But they got to know them, and they got to realize what I had done compared with what they had done too, you know. So it worked out sort of that way, you know. And then what I did was when my husband passed away, they finally decided he had bipolar for years and never knew it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. I just fought with it all along, and finally in desperation he had to go into the New Jersey Veterans Home in Paramus. And he had been an ordained Catholic deacon, and he acted as a deacon there, and then I went and helped him with the programs. He would do the religious end, I'd do the music end. Mm-hmm. And the girls always went along with us with whatever we were doing, you know. And the oldest girl, she lives in Cambridgeshire, England, and she, when she finished graduate school at the University of Kentucky, somebody said to my husband and I, that's great that Susan's going to teach in a third world country. We said, what? Neither of us knew a thing about it. So we said, what's going on? She said, well, you and Daddy do things to help other people. Now it's my turn. I said, wait a minute, you got all your sisters coming after you. You know, you could be a... She had such good offers for jobs, and she turned them all down. Hmm. And so she went to Africa, and she taught in one of the third world countries, and she was an ag student, so she was to teach them how to raise, mm-hmm. You know, the food and so on. And then it ended up that they needed the teachers, and there was no school. I got to give her credit. She built the school by hand. She, when she first went to this place, it was called Lesotho, it's South Africa, she was teaching outdoors. There was no school. Mm-hmm. I said, well, Susan, how could you teach? She said, in the dirt, Mom, with sticks. I said, well, suppose you're doing math and somebody cheats. She said, I just turned my back and they beat them with the sticks, that's all, because they know that they cheated. But anyway, she eventually, she wrote to Cardinal Cook in New York because he lived in the Bronx. He lived in the next parish to ours, near Pelham Bay. And she said that her mother and father and grandmother and grandfather had always contributed to the church, never asked anything. Now she wanted it. She wanted money to build a school in this village where it was like a missionary post, mm-hmm. but it was huge. It was a big village. And so she listed everything she wanted, the bricks and the mortar and the whatnot, you know. And Cardinal Cook sent her his own check. He said, it's too bad we don't have more people like you, because my daughter said, all of these donations that I've seen people give to the church, I've never seen one bit of it since I've been in Africa. Let's do it the right way. So when she told my father, oh, God, he was fooled. You wrote to the cardinal and asked for money? She said, I sure did. Oh, this one's great, believe me. She just came back from Sri Lanka. And where the heck is she now? I don't even know. But anyway, while she was in South Africa, this fellow came from England with the Save the Children Foundation, and he came with two Mercedes-Benz trucks to build roads and mm-hmm. show them how to... So... I don't know how long after she was there that he came, but she wrote to my husband and I, and she said, John has asked me to marry him. We didn't know who John was. That was Black Africa. You can't bring somebody into Lyndhurst. So I said, please send us a picture of our future son-in-law. He had on a safari hat like this. Couldn't see his face. Well, anyway, they were married in Africa, and they backpacked. And the experiences that she had, you would never believe it.
It sounds like you raised, I mean, some very, very strong, independent daughters.
And I never thought of that. They were just my kids, you know. But she sent a note to me, and she said, we've watched you and Daddy help people and do things all your life, and why should we sit back and not do it, you know? And then when Beth came along, the second girl, and she was in the nursing and so on. And so in her book, the second book that is in the 11th printing, she that's how she begins it. She said, I never realized what my mother stood for until I was grown up. And this is the kind of story I want you to hear, or something about these women who were captured. And that's quite a book. You should read that
someday.
Yeah, I'd like to. It's, but anyway, and the new book comes out in December. That's called Cries in the Darkness, about the men that were in the death march, British and American. And they were, she finally got permission from the Japanese government to go to Japan with her husband and interview the guards that were the and they were, they found 20 of them. I said, how could you find, that's years ago. She said the Japs took them in when they were 16 and 17, so they're young.
They're younger than.
But anyway, up to that point she had written, tried to get permission, but they would never admit what they had done, so they finally didn't. I think it was how many years ago, she and her husband went to Japan and got an interpreter from the university, and they interviewed these Japanese guards, and of course they asked the same thing, you know, did you ever kill Americans? Oh, yes. Why? It was war, you know. And they were saying how the Americans, this one man said he had to get them up every morning to go down in the mines, he said, and the British, they would walk along and they would sing. He said, the Americans, they didn't care. So Beth said to the interpreter, ask him what they sang. So he put his hat down and he goes, it's a long way to Tipperary. She said, that's an old World War One song. But anyway, and what they tried to do, which I think was a bit balmy, but she and her husband decided that they went to Manila, where the prisoner of war camp was that the American women were in after they were taken from, and they were going to walk the 65 miles
of the march,
of the death march. And oh, she bought all this special lightweight clothing and whatnot. They couldn't do it. It was too overgrown. I don't know how far into it they got, but I guess the whoever was sponsoring them must have said, it's too dangerous. But what they did get information from, and I thought that was interesting, there were Americans that stayed in the Philippines and married Filipinos, and they still lived in little pockets along where this march had been. And they talked to them, they got a lot of information from them on what actually happened on the march and everything. And where they didn't have much luck is when the, if you got weak in that march, they would knock you out with a, and then shoot you and kick you to the side of the road. But the Filipinos couldn't let them lay there in that hot weather, so they just dug graves. And half the time, their dog tags were gone. They didn't know who they were, so there was no way they could get that together. They tried for a long while. It just didn't work out, you know. But anyway, so she, when she started to work with these women that were in that prisoner of war camp, and she said to me one day, do you want to meet Cassie? She said, when you write a book, Mom, you can't write about 100 people or something. You've got to narrow it down. And she said, I'm taking this one person who lives outside of Trenton, Germantown, Pennsylvania. And she said, I'm going to pick up this other woman who just moved from the West Coast, who was in the prisoner of war camp with Cassie. I said, I'd love to go. And on the way down, I said, gee, Beth, I'm getting goose flesh thinking about it, you know. So we got to the restaurant outside of Trenton, and Cassie, big strapping woman, standing there in the lobby with her hands on her hips, and the thin little woman walked in with Beth and I, and she said, my God, Millie, you never changed. 53 years after that, they hugged and they cried, and the restaurant didn't know what was going on. you know. But they said that the thin little woman with us was the only one that had the strength to climb a tree. Every night she climbed to look at the horizon to see if they were ever going to be rescued. Mm. Every night. And while the Japs, this is odd, the Japs never raped one of them. Mm. They beat them. Mm-hmm. And they starved them. And when I listened to some of the things that those women did just to stay alive, unbelievable. But the Japs didn't do that because they needed our American nurses. They didn't have their own. But one incident I thought was unusual, but you'd read it in the book anyway, mm-hmm. if you get it. When the Japanese came to take over, Skinny Wainwright, General Wainwright, had to surrender. And it was the first time in American history that we surrendered. Mm. But he said, I can't allow them to take you 69 women. I know what they'll do to you. Mm-hmm. And so he went out with the white flag, and he said to them, but I want all of you to dress not in your nurse's uniform, in your army uniforms, and to stand there and keep your eyes on the ground. Don't look at them. So the Japs were standing opposite them. Mm-hmm. You know, and the Jap officer kept going back and forth, shaking his head, and he went over to one woman, and he felt her lapels, and he felt his. It was the same. He said, he didn't know who they were. Mm-hmm. Men dressed in women's uniform, he didn't know what it was. Well, anyway, and they were scared to death. They didn't know what was going to happen to mm-hmm. them. But anyway, when they were eventually released, you know, when the Americans got there, it was 3.5 years later. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't have the manpower, we didn't have the
right
to go in and rescue those women. But when they did, the Japs had gotten word that they were going to incinerate the camp. Over 4,000 people were there. And they were bringing in all these big oil drums, and the women, everybody didn't know what was going on. So the Americans got the jump on them, and they, I think they had a drop, you know, a parachute drop, mm-hmm. and right in back of them were the tanks. And the Japs cleared out the morning that they arrived. And when the Americans came over, the nurses, just, they didn't believe that they were Americans. So this one soldier said, look, we're one of you. She went over, she pinched his cheek, she said, you're real, aren't you? Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, I am, you know. But,
I have to wonder, you know, you said, you know, they're your daughters, you didn't think about, they were just your daughters.
Yes, they were, yeah.
But do you think that, I mean, your experiences that you had as a spar helped, I mean, influence this?
Yes,
how?
It did.
I mean, you're raising
up. Well, I think a little of the, how could I say it now? The way they lived, like 5 girls together, that's miserable. Mm-hmm. You know, you're stealing my clothes and all that kind of thing. I was rigid about that, you know. Now, these, you know, it's sharing, but let's not mm-hmm. haggle over them. But I tried to reason with them as much as I could. They tried to get away with everything, like all kids did, you know. But I tried to reason with them, and because financially we weren't too well off, mm-hmm. We could never go on vacations, and we bought a tent with green stamps or plaid stamps, I forget, and we camped, and we did a lot of things together that I think helped a lot in having them grow. But, and we're avid readers, and every one of them, and I get a kick out of this when I go to their homes today, they're all married, they've all got bathroom book racks with their books in them, you know. And I thought, oh, at least they picked that up, you know. And different things that I did when they were living at home, I see in their houses too, you know. But I guess it was an influence on them, you know.
And well, it just seems like this idea that they could do, I don't know, whatever they wanted to do.
No, they couldn't.
No, I mean, as far as...
Yeah, yeah.
As far as for their future, not necessarily...
Oh, for their future, no, we did... my husband and I tried very strongly to influence them if they were going in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. Now, the older girl had always loved the land and the garden and whatnot, and she definitely wanted to go into ag. Mm-hmm. And so that was fine. She did. In fact, she was the first woman to graduate from the University of Kentucky Ag School. And when we went down to graduation, it was a big plaque, a bronze plaque with Susan Dempsey on the wall. We were so proud, you know.
Yeah, no kidding.
But and then when Beth came along and she got her, she went to Rutgers. That's a 5-year nursing program. And then she eventually taught there. And then when she got this chance to go to NYU, she said, "I don't think they're going to take me, Mom. They're taking more mature women." And I said, "Well, stick to it. They might, you know." So they did. And mm-hmm. so that worked out very well. And then the third girl, the only oddball, there's one in every family, you know. Happy-go-lucky. Don't send me to college. I'm not going to learn. I'm just, don't do it, Mom. Don't waste your money on me. So we said, "All right, so you go to business school." So she went out and did secretarial work and whatnot, you know. But she was always a fly-by-night. Happy-go-lucky. I mean, that's the way it is. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and oddly enough, when my oldest girl backpacked from South Africa to the north and went home to live in England, in mm-hmm. Harrow, where her husband's people were, of course, we knew that would be where she'd live the rest of her life. So this middle girl said, "I hate to see my sister in a foreign country, you know, at Christmas." So we said, "All right, we'll pay for you to go over and we'll give you our Christmas presents." And she met the brother that Christmas. And she never met anybody like him. She was engaged to somebody here in New Jersey, but she never met anybody like this fella. But the British are quiet, but they're strong. Well, anyway, so when she came home, she said, "I don't know what to do, Mom." She said, "I've never met anybody like him." And I said, "Well, don't jump into the other situation. You know, don't rush into it." So anyway, the English fella that she had just met, after he came to America finally, and we met him and so on, and he had been a teacher in England, and he gave it up, and he didn't, because when he finished his education, they put him in an all-girls school. He was a young, good-looking British guy. So the headmaster got mad and made him mow the lawn, wash the windows. He said, "I'm a professional. I'm not a gardener." So he quit after a year. He says, "I would never go back to teaching." Well, anyway, and, you know, oddly enough, I was thinking about this recently. All five of those girls are married and no divorces, but somehow they all get along with their mates really well. And I've sometimes sat back and said, how could that be? They just mesh mm-hmm. for some reason or other. But anyway, this fellow, the English fellow, sent a letter to my husband and I after he went home, and he said, "I've never met anybody like your daughter." And he went on to say what he admired about her, that he'd never seen that in any of the English girls. And he asked for our permission for his hand in marriage. And I said to Jack, my husband, "Wow, that's never been done, you know." Mm-hmm. But anyway, we said, yes, we would be more than happy to have him be our son-in-law, you know. Mm-hmm. So they were married in the summer. I don't live in New Jersey. I live up on the Canadian border, up on Lake Ontario. Mm-hmm. Do you know what the Thousand Islands are?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you come down the St. Lawrence where it meets Lake Ontario, that's where I live.
Mm-hmm.
The American side. I can see Canada from the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so the kids were all raised up there. You know, from, I guess the youngest one was 4. And I don't know whether it's that we stuck together as a family. I don't know what the reason is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why these things, am I keeping you?
No, not at all.
But it's somehow or other, it's worked out, you know, mm-hmm. with all of them. But so the third one, that's the fourth one, she was always a little different from the other girls, but she is a teacher, and unfortunately, 6 years ago, she had a massive brain tumor.
Oh, no.
And she said, "Mom, I think my eyes are going bad." When they did an MRI, the tumor started here in the nose, in the sinuses, went up this way across the forehead, almost like the shape of a tree, and her chances were not good. And she had 3 children, young.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "You can't take care of them anymore, Mom." She said, "I can't leave them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take that chance. I'm going through with it." So the girl that's in nursing, she said, "Look, we'll get the best brain tumor for that type of tumor."
Mm-hmm.
And where was it? But in Hershey, Pennsylvania. She lives 8 miles from Hershey. So it was an 11 and a half hour surgery. They had to move the face. I didn't know that was done.
Mm-hmm.
The whole face came down. And the only thing that the surgeon was telling us is that he couldn't get part of it that was in the... there's so much in the sinuses, mm-hmm, or something. So she has no sense of smell or taste. But she said that's nothing.
She survived?
She survived.
Wow.
And she's doing beautifully back teaching.
Wow.
And... all of the girls stood together, and I sat there at the bed with her, and her face was black for days,
mm-hmm,
and just held her hand. I said, "Joan, did you know I was there?" She said, "Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I could tell by your hand."
Mm.
And so she survived it, and
it's amazing.
So she and my fifth girl, she was also an agricultural major. And she liked the earth, mm-hmm, sort of like the older girl did. And she went to Penn State, and she met her husband at Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
He was graduating. She had another year to go. And so they farm in the Berkshire, Northampton, Massachusetts, mm-hmm, near Smith College.
Mm-hmm.
And they when I look at them and I see how well they get along, they have a big spread, almost a big part of the valley. They're, they have, it's like a business now, you,
mm-hmm,
know, and they get along so well,
mm-hmm,
and the girl that had the brain tumor, that fella never left her side,
mm,
and still, even today, he does so much for her,
mm-hmm,
and the English fella that asked for her, our permission, he'd do anything for her, and she can do kooky things, I'll tell you, but, and he had said to my husband and I, he lost his mother and his father just after they were married. He said, "I'll always be here for you," and you know, baby. And he still is.
Mm.
He drives me up to the Lake Ontario because I can't drive that far anymore, and he stays with me for a day or two. Then he comes back and gets me at the end of the summer, and he does everything for me.
Mm.
Both British son-in-laws are just wonderful, I'm telling you. And there's a stick-togetherness there with them, you know. And the girl that's the writer, she and her husband do everything together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess we're fortunate in the way that they just happen to meet people that fit in with what they were doing, you know?
No, yeah, really nicely.
But I think, though, as they never say it openly. They're not the gushy kind, but I heard the oldest girl say one time, "Well, you set the pace, we followed." I don't know, but she's the one that taught in Africa, and then, as I say, she's been all over creation. And I said to her, oh, well, she's in Albania this week.
Mm-hmm.
She did some teaching at where she's, you know, in school, the, mm-hmm, Cambridge, but only for a while. And then she went in to do some other field of education. I'm not quite sure which. Oh, but you'd get a laugh out of this. I went over there 5 or 6 years ago,
mm-hmm,
and I took my best friend with me, got off the plane, and she said, "Mom, you're on BBC on Friday." I said, "For what?" She said, "They're having a discussion here on why American women went into the military when they weren't conscripted like the women here in England." I said, "Well, didn't they know we wanted to help?" She said, "Well, that's what they want you to tell them." I said, "I don't have anything prepared." She said, "Let them ask you, you know."
Mm-hmm.
So she said, "You're to take Eileen with you." So we went into to Cambridge, to the BBC. And they set us up for this broadcast. And they said, "Now, we're going to ask you a few questions and you answer them," and so on. So Eileen said, "Oh, well, I was never in the military." He said, "What did you do?" She said, "I worked for, what was it? The telephone company or something in New York."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "During the war, what did you do?" She said, "Well, I went to apply for the job." And she said, "They asked me if I could roller skate." So she said, "Yeah, sure, I can roller skate." They said, "Bring your skates with you when you come to work." It was a big, huge loft in New York City. And she had to go around. If you had a message, you'd stick it in one finger, she'd roller skate to the next one. I never heard of such a thing. So it was hysterical. So anyway, he said, "Have you been friends for long?" She said, "Yeah, she's a year younger than me, though." Laughing, but anyway, and I said, "Don't tell them how old we are." But anyway, so they wanted to know how I went in and everything, and why did we go in when we didn't have to go in like their women? And I said, because we wanted to help, and your women set the precedent for us. I said, did you know that it was through England and Canada that we went in? We used your basis to start our military. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, but that's interesting. I said, we met the British woman that did that in Washington one time. But anyway, it was really interesting. So when we came out of the BBC, I said to Eileen, can you beat it? We're both on BBC. We're only here one day. You know? So, and then I keep in touch with somebody in her village who was in the Royal Navy. And when she goes to her reunion, she sends me her things, and I send her mine from America, you know.
Oh, how fun.
And I didn't know that we had Wrens here in America working
yeah,
in Washington.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, yes, they had them. And I said, isn't that funny? I never knew that, you
yeah.
know. But my whole objective in life now is to keep promoting the fact that women have served in the military. And what I did was, after I retired from teaching, I went into it in a deeper way. And I'm always trying to find something else about the women who served through the years. Mm-hmm. And then I vary it and I break it down. I speak to the Daughters of the American Revolution, the American Legion, any of these people. But I think it was, I don't know how many years ago, it was 2003. But anyway, did you know that there are very few monuments ever to women?
Mm-hmm.
I could find only five or six.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I think it's a disgrace. I said, we should have one here in New Jersey, you know. So I've been serving on the New Jersey Commission for Women Veterans. I just resigned in the fall because New Jersey's having a shake-up and I don't know where we're at.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I think I've done my share. But anyway, I was sitting at this board table and they said, well, you like to sketch, don't you? I said, yeah. And they said, sketch something and see if we can get that made into a monument. I said, well, wait a minute. You can't give it a World War II uniform or Vietnam. What'll mm-hmm. we do? So we talked about it and I said, why don't we bring it back to, there were Minute Women. At the time, they had the Minutemen, before
mm-hmm.
we had a military group. Why don't we make it that era? So I sketched a woman. Oh, I don't have it with me. I might have the pin with me. It's upstairs on my uniform. I sketched a woman dressed in 1700s clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And I used the posture. Do you know what the Minuteman's, the famous?
Mm-hmm.
I used the same posture, like she's leaning in the same direction. Where he had a gun and a plow, I gave her a musket with a child at her skirt, and then she's holding a lantern. And each piece is symbolic. The lantern is that she's lighting the way for her family to a new life
mm-hmm.
By helping our country. And the child, she's protecting her home. And the musket, she can use it if she has to. You know,
mm-hmm.
she's trained in it. So anyway, they sent it in. The governor approved it. And I think about 2 years later, I got this letter that they were casting it in clay
mm-hmm.
when I come down to Tom's River and go to the studio and see if I approved. So I thought, geez, I'm just, I don't think I'm anybody really,
mm-hmm.
but to have a monument made. So I went to this studio way out in the woods in Tom's River, and there's this big, about as tall as I was, statue of the Minute Woman in clay. And oh, my heart was beating right up in my throat. And he said, do you like it? I changed the head a little bit. I said, it doesn't matter. Whatever you did, it represents women who served. And so, anyway, it was approved and cast in the bronze.
Mm.
And it's in the New Jersey Veterans Cemetery at Arneytown. And it was unveiled 2003.
Mm.
And the base of it, a Marine woman, put dedicated to all American women who served their country, American women veterans, you know. So I was down to see it again sometime last year, and every time I see that, I get a lump in my throat. She represents the women, you know, in our country, and it was really, if I have the pin with me, I'll have to show it to you.
Definitely.
But we had them made into little pins.
Mm.
Because New Jersey said that they would pay for the casting and everything, and then they backed out.
Of course, yeah, because they have no money.
So we had, how are we going to, we're from different parts of the state and all that, you know. So we tried, we had these made into little pins, and we sold them for $5,
mm-hmm.
I think. And we were able to do pretty well with sales and things, you know. But then we really made a contact in Trenton, and we got somebody to say that they would pick up what was left, which they did, you know. So, but we're only one of maybe, I don't know how many states, and I tried all over to find, Long Island has one, but she's got boots on and like a Vietnam era.
Yeah, yeah, there's not that many. I think does this seem like a logical place for us to pause at this, to stop?
Of course,
okay.
Yes.
I mean, I know we could continue talking for hours.
Probably.